This is St. Louis on the Air from St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Danny Wisentowski. This weekend, thousands packed the streets of downtown St. Louis and the Dogtown neighborhood. It was a sea of green, a celebration of St. Patrick's Day with all the fixings. Leprechauns, Guinness, and four-leaf clovers, dancers and drinkers joining together in just a wee bit of revelry. But go back about 180 years, to the 1840s, and St. Louis was a very different place for Irish Americans. Those who managed to make it here often lived in poverty in an area in the north of the city called the Carey Patch. But St. Louis's Irish community had someone in their corner, a lawyer, who came from a family of wealth and distinction. His name was Brian Mullanphy, and it's a name that you might recognize as a street or a park or a local school. Brian Mullanphy lived quite the life and on his own terms, even when those terms were troublesome. And to talk about what he meant to St. Louis and to its struggling Irish community at the time, I'm joined by Jackie Dana. She's a writer and creator of the Unseen St. Louis Substack, and this weekend she published a lengthy dive into the peculiar life of Brian Mullanphy. Jackie, welcome back to St. Louis on the Air.
Thank you for having me.
So Jackie, let's dive right into the life of Brian Mullanphy. He served as St. Louis's 10th mayor from 1847 to 1848. Give us just a bit of context here and set the scene for us. What was life like for St. Louis's Irish population at this time?
Well, when he was alive, St. Louis was a brand new city. He moved here after studying in Europe just around when St. Louis was established. Before his time, the Irish here were largely wealthy men who came here because, unlike many places in the United States, it was a place that was seen as friendly to Catholics because of the French and the Spanish settlers here. And so they would be coming here to start up businesses, get into different merchant types of activities, fur trading, things like that. But then you have, in the 1840s, what we call the Irish potato famine, known more appropriately as the Great Hunger, because there really wasn't a famine. But you had thousands and thousands of Irish coming to the United States, fleeing this situation, and many of them landed here because, again, it was known to be friendly to Catholics, which a lot of places in the country were not.
Now, like you said, this was a very different St. Louis. The city was under 20,000 people in population at this time. And this location where a lot of these folks did wind up, the Carey Patch, you wrote about this last year for last year's St. Patrick's Day, but this was actually where you first became fascinated with Brian Mullanphy. What was that connection and what made you think, like, I got to know more about this guy?
Well, when I was researching the Carey Patch, the Mullanphy family came up because John Mullanphy, his father, had been St. Louis's first millionaire, and his children inherited all this land that John Mullanphy had. And in particular, Ann Biddle, his daughter, owned all the land that is in what we would now call Old North St. Louis, the area between, let's say, Jefferson and the river, north of Franklin, Cass, kind of in that area where the NGA is now. And when I was researching the Carey Patch and where all these Irish came to settle, the Mullanphys just were all over the place. And one story that I encountered, which appears to be apocryphal, not accurate, was that his father had disinherited Brian of all of his money because he wasn't happy with his lifestyle and the way he was spending money. But as I dug into it more, I realized that actually wasn't the case. But that story was so compelling. I'm like, why would this have happened, that I had to know more?
Yeah. And now Brian Mullanphy's father, John, as you mentioned, he was an important person at this time, being a millionaire. It did seem, though, there was some evidence that he was not always happy with his son or the direction of his son's life.
No, that's exactly right. So John Mullanphy really, he came here wanting to make his way in the world, and he wanted all of his children to be these, you know, gentlemen and, society women, the wealthy elite of the city. And his son went to all the good schools. He was one of the first students and possibly the first graduate of St. Louis University studying law. You know, he did everything right, but he was also a little bit of an eccentric character, and he didn't really worry about what people thought of him. And one story that I tell is how when he was coming back from school in England, he's going up the river, and this, I don't know when this was, probably February. You know how St. Louis gets, it gets very cold. And at the time, the river was icy at St. Louis, so everybody had to disembark from the steamboat south of St. Louis and get to the city however they could. And Brian hires a mule and rides bareback to the city, shows up at his father's doorstep covered in mud. And that was sort of emblematic of how their relationship was. Brian did what he thought he wanted to do, but his father wasn't always so impressed by that.
Now, John Melanfi dies in 1833. That leaves Brian Melanfi to kind of chart his life as the only son of one of the wealthiest people in the city. This must have been kind of an odd time. As you see, the Irish folks who are fleeing the Great Hunger, they arrive, you know, in the next 10 years. But he is incredibly wealthy and is not in that position. He's not living in the Kerry Patch. Was his family an outlier in some ways?
Actually, no. There were quite a few wealthy Irish families here. You have, for example, O'Fallon, and you have the Chambers, some of which, like, they're all friends or intermarrying. But there were quite a few wealthy Irish here. But Brian was practicing law, and then he became circuit court judge. And I'm not sure exactly how he became the mayor, like how that discussion happened, but he was convinced to run for mayor, and he became mayor just as all these people were arriving here. And he witnessed firsthand the extreme poverty that these people had. They had literally nothing but the clothes on their back in most cases. And they show up here, often not even speaking English, speaking Irish Gaelic, with, you know, not a cent to their name, and trying to make their way.
Now, what do we know about Brian Melanfi's personal life? You're basing on newspapers. We have things that people, you know, wrote about him. You write that he was a peculiar person, or seen as a peculiar
yes.
person. What does that mean?
Every single account of his life, including letters that his family wrote to each other, would reference his odd behavior over the years. Like I say, the mule incident is one of many, many stories. Some, you know, might not be true, or they may have been heavily embellished, but there are so many of them, and they are so funny because he didn't do what people expected him to do. Like, accounts talk about him walking around the streets playing a banjo. He would go into the Kerry Patch and with his sister Anne hand out supplies and money to people personally. You know, imagine a wealthy person today going into the slums of a city and just handing out cash. That's just not something that is done now, and it certainly wasn't done back in the day either. So people were really perplexed by him, I would say, his entire life.
And you mentioned this notion of finding humor in his life, and it didn't sound like his life was particularly easy or happy in some cases. Are there other places where you did see that humor?
Well, he had this habit of, like I say, doing things the way he wanted them done. And as I discuss in my article, there was an incident where he went out with a friend of his who was an actor in a local theater, and they went out for a ride, and they get 10, 12 miles outside the city, which, imagine, this is at a time when all the roads are dirt roads and the city doesn't even reach Grand. It's a very small place. And they go all the way out into the country, and they have some sort of disagreement. And Brian's like, you know what? If your legs work as well as your mouth, I'm sure you'll be fine. And he takes off and rides back to the city alone, leaving this poor actor to find his way back and try to make it in time for curtain call for a play he was in that evening. And even though that would seem like a very mean-spirited thing, apparently they were still friends and they hung out a few days later. But this is just, I mean, he would just do things like that. And it makes me wonder if he might have been, like we would think today, maybe on the spectrum a little bit. There's so many little quirky things about him like that. But, you know, I'm not going to try to diagnose him, you know, 150 years later.
Yeah. And, you know, to that point, one of the other things that you found is, you know, he was a bachelor, a lifelong bachelor. And I think we might be familiar with the terms of like a confirmed bachelor. We don't know why that was, correct? But it was notable and people talked about it.
Yeah. It's very unusual. Imagine the son of the richest or one of the richest men in the city. The first millionaire for sure, but somebody may have, you know, had more money when he died. But Brian was certainly the only son. The name Melanfi died with him. There must have been incredible pressure, societal pressure, if not family pressure, for him to marry and have children. And he tells the story about how when he was a young man, and he told friends this, whether this is actually true or not, we don't know. But when he was a young man, he went out to propose to this young German girl. And he got dressed up and got all ready to go, hired a buggy, went out to the country to her house. Along the way, he finds a horseshoe, stops and picks it up, thinking that's going to be great luck for him. He shows up at her house. The maid brings him inside and says, you know, just have a seat. She's currently entertaining another caller, what we would think. And he sits down and he hears through a closed door this woman speaking to another man. And according to the story that he told, they were making fun of Brian. And so he, you know, you can just imagine this man just all proud and excited, just, you know, dusting himself off, picking himself up and getting back on that buggy and heading home. And then after that, he decided he didn't ever want to pursue another relationship. Now, this is a very odd story. And given his life as a bachelor and his very close association with many male figures and attorneys at the time, it makes me wonder if he was truly unmarried because of this relationship, or if there might have been some other reasons. But history, unfortunately, has not been kind enough to document any other reasons for his ongoing bachelor lifestyle.
If you have a smart speaker, you have access to the entire world of NPR and St. Louis Public Radio. All the latest news and all the captivating stories. Activate our voices with yours by telling your smart speaker to play St. Louis Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Danny Wisentowski, in for Elaine Cha. I'm here with Unseen St. Louis writer Jackie Dana, and we're talking about the life of Irish St. Louis and Brian Melanfi. He was the 10th mayor of St. Louis in 1847, but as we were discussing before the break, he was the son of St. Louis's first millionaire. He lived an eccentric life. He was a lifelong bachelor, and that was just the beginning. Jackie, Brian Melanfi in 1836 became involved in one of, I think, the most infamous incidents in the pre-Civil War in Missouri. This was the case of abolitionist Elijah Lovejoy and a mob that attacked his printing press. And Brian Melanfi is a character in this incident. So remind us a bit about Elijah Lovejoy and what was Brian Melanfi's role in this incident?
Well, Elijah Lovejoy is a complicated figure in this story because he had come here publishing the St. Louis Observer newspaper, which was many things, but it was an abolitionist newspaper, but it was also often an anti-Catholic paper. This is at a period where Catholicism and the Catholics were seen as undesirable by many in the United States. And yet, he did do some very good things. It's one of the problems with history is nobody is all black or white, right? You know, we have those shades of gray. He published an editorial criticizing Judge Luke Lawless, who was the circuit court judge at the time, for refusing to convict anybody for the lynching of free black man Francis McIntosh. And as a result, a mob came to his offices where he was publishing the newspaper and attacked the printing press, eventually smashing it and throwing it into the river. And of the entire city, the city watch did nothing, and no city officials were willing to do anything except Brian Malanfi, who at the time was one of our aldermen. And he tried to help protect the printing press, despite the fact that it was not necessarily in his personal best interests. He was obviously Catholic and would not have agreed with a lot of what Elijah Lovejoy would have been publishing. He was not, as far as I could tell, an abolitionist either, but he did see that this was wrong, that this was, you know, Lovejoy had the right to free speech, and he tried to step in, but unfortunately wasn't able to save it.
Now, on that point, you know, the complexity of history kind of presents itself to us, you know, in the information that we still do have, and the idea of what was Brian Malanfi's view of slavery, of abolition. You did try to figure out, you know, where that was. You did also find out that his parents or most or all of his siblings did own enslaved people. Can you tell us a bit about what you found here?
Yeah. So it's unquestionable that John Malanfi, his father, and most of his family were slave owners. Not huge numbers, not like, you know, southern plantation levels, but definitely in the, probably a dozen or more. They had, you know, nice houses. His sister Jane was given Taita Noye up in Florissant. And although that wasn't ever really a working farm with, you know, like lots of slaves, they definitely had slaves working the land, and other enslaved people were, you know, helping build out the house and things like that, as far as I can tell, or at least it's a suspicion. But Brian himself, it's hard to tell. After his death, the probate documents do show that he officially owned one slave family, a husband and wife and some children, although I've never been able to figure out what they would have done for him. He lived in the city in hotels and in a small apartment. He really had no need for that kind of, maybe one or two people, but not a family. So I suspect maybe they lived with one of his family members and he had inherited them, but I don't know that for a fact. What I do know is that when he was circuit court judge, he presided over a number of freedom trials, and those would be where an enslaved person had some reason to believe that they should be set free. Perhaps their owner had said upon their death they would be freed, and then that didn't happen or something like that. And he did free some of these people. And according to the materials that I've read, things got much worse for these enslaved people after he was no longer judge. I never saw anything that indicated that he himself came out against slavery as an institution. But he did really believe in fairness and kindness and helping the poor. And so I can't imagine that he wouldn't have been able to recognize the situation of somebody who was a slave at that time, and that might not have been the best situation. But again, there's no historical records that suggest that he actually came out against slavery, unfortunately.
Right. And you know, this was, you know, 1840. We're about, you know, 20 years before the Civil War. He steps down from the bench as a judge in 1844, and then he's mayor in 1847 for 1 year. That was the length of these terms back then. What do we know about his mayorship?
Well, it's funny because, again, I wish I knew exactly how he ended up being the Democratic candidate and what conversations went into that. But he did run for mayor and got elected by a sizable margin. But this is, again, at a time when the Democratic Party had grown considerably because of all the Irish and the Germans that had come here as immigrants. And so he, as mayor, wanted to work with everyone. And he had Whigs and others that he wanted to work with in his administration. But the Democrats in the administration were not fond of that. The aldermen, the city council was very hostile to the idea. He then tried to basically put gravel down on Gravois Road because it was a dirt road, and that's how all the clay wagons would, the coal wagons, sorry, would bring in the coal for the city. That was shot down. He tried to drain Shoto's Pond, which was where Mill Creek Valley had been dammed up for a mill, and it had become full of pollution because of all the new industry, and the city also turned that down. They wanted to do some other things that he turned down. So unfortunately, his term as mayor was not the most effective period in his life. He didn't actually accomplish much in that year.
Now, I want to go toward the end of his life because there are a few notable pieces here. One is that it seems like, you know, he dies only a few years after being mayor in 1851. And you write that those final 3 years of his life seemed particularly difficult. What do we know about what was going on?
Right. So in 1849, he apparently was hospitalized at the Sisters of Charity Hospital that his father had actually formed. And based on letters between family members and some attorneys, there was some very grave concerns about his mental health. There were lots of uses of the word insane and of unsound mind and things like that. There was a hearing at one point to determine whether or not he was insane. And again, these are words that they used. And one of his family members suggested that he may never recover, and they were looking at trying to appoint a guardian to oversee his estate because, again, he had a considerable amount of wealth and land. And this is in what I've seen, January through April of 1849. But by the summer, he was out and about, back to his ordinary kind of life. He was an attorney again. He was this was the period where he went out with the friend who was the actor out to the country. So I'm not really sure exactly what it was. One idea that has come up is that one of the newspapers referred to his dissolute lifestyle, and he had given a speech to a temperance organization. And I'm thinking maybe his drinking got the better of him. And given what he had to deal with politically, he had a dispute with an attorney that was one of the freedom suit lawyers that I'll be talking about in a talk later this week.
I'm sorry. I did just want there. I wanted to make sure we get to this one point. One of the last things he did in his life, you know, and maybe raising these questions of what was his mental state. He leaves a third of his estate, somewhere between $200,000 and $250,000, to the city of St. Louis. I punched these numbers in just to get a sense. This is somewhere in the realm of $7 million today. What happened there?
Well, okay, so he went through all of this, and like I say, he had a really rough life, but he mostly saw these immigrants and the struggles that they went through. And like I say, I think that may have been what drove him to drink, if anything, just the extreme poverty. And so when he died, he did will a third of his estate to the city of St. Louis in trust to take care of the immigrants that came through the city. And, you know, I think that it must have been very difficult to be somebody who cared so much about the poor and realize there was only so much he could do.
And, you know, you write about, you know, what that money went towards and why it was important to him. And you'd also written about the Melanfi Emigrant Home, which burned down just last year. And that was one of the institutions that money went to build, correct?
Correct.
You know, looking back on this, just, you know, in our last, you know, minute or so here, what stands out to you about, you know, his legacy and why, you know, why we still have his name on several things in this city? What does that mean to you today?
Well, I think he represented a different way of looking at the least desirable, quote unquote, people in our society. And like I mentioned in my article, you know, even today, you know, we have a lot of anti-immigrant sentiment and social divisiveness. And I think we can look back at somebody like him as somebody who saw past all of that and wanted to help people and do something that was kind and that was right and didn't hold it against people who were poor and were just looking for a better life. Because really, I mean, that's why he was here. His parents had moved here to have a better life. And frankly, if you look at pretty much all of our backgrounds, with very few exceptions, our ancestors came here for the same reasons. And it's lovely to think that somebody was taking care of some of maybe our grandparents, our great-great-grandparents, however, you know, back in the day.
This episode was produced by Danny Wisentowski.
Audio engineering and podcast design by Aaron Dorr.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
St. Louis on the Air proudly supports local artists by using music from Life Creative Group.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thank you.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri, St. Louis.
The Gateway brings you the day's news from the St. Louis region and across Missouri. It also includes stories from the Illinois side of the river and our Metro East reporter, Will Bauer.
In Alton, in Belleville, in East St. Louis, in Edwardsville, in Cahokia Heights, at Scott Air Force Base, I'm Will Bauer, St. Louis Public Radio.
Listen to reports from Will and all of our journalists weekdays on the Gateway, on the STLPR app, and wherever you get podcasts.